The Texas legislature's recently taken up charges focused on mental health. Can those priorities maintain momentum into the next session? Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Mental health has been used in the same sentence a lot lately as mass violence, breaking down that connection. As loved ones gather this holiday, one discussion point might be family history, digging deep into what that means for one Texas family. Don't ask, don't tell. It seems that's still largely the policy when it comes to mental health at work. How to change that? Plus, mental health policing and the courts on a special edition of the Texas Standard. From Amarillo to Austin, Houston to Harlingen, and of course a special shout out to Turkey, Texas today, and to Cuero, the so-called turkey capital of the world. No matter where you're listening, I hope you're having a great Thanksgiving. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Not everyone gets to have that postcard family gathering around the dining room table today, but whether you're gathering with friends instead, or coworkers, or just us here on the radio, it's traditionally a time to get reflective, share stories and experiences. One dialogue we thought we'd start today is one on mental health. It's actually a conversation that's been going on for a while now in our country, though many question the reasons for that. We're dedicating our whole show today to mental health, and while we won't presume to cover it all, we'll take a deep dive, starting with mental health, politics, policy, and the way it's being discussed of late in relation to mass violence. Joining me in the studio to help us do that is Greg Hanch. He's the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Texas. Greg, thank you for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
And Colleen Horton, she is the director of policy at the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, based at the University of Texas at Austin. Colleen, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Laura. It's always nice to be with you and Greg.
Colleen, I want to start with you. Where are we right now in Texas as compared to the rest of the country when it comes to mental health care and policies?
I think it's a mix. We have some programs and services and initiatives that are way ahead of what other parts of the country are doing. For instance, we have a new unit at the Health and Human Service Commission with a new director of peer support services, which is a huge move forward in getting the right kind of services to people with mental health conditions. We also have a new consortium on children's mental health, and $99 million was devoted to that. We still are probably not in this, you know, top half of funding for mental health across the state. I hesitate to use some of the national rankings because they're not always comparing apples to apples. Right. But I think even with that said, we still have a ways to go on our per capita spending on mental health for people in Texas.
Greg, I mentioned mental health has been on the lips of many Texas politicians, especially since recent mass shootings in the state. But how successful would you say just this past state legislative session was in passing mental health-focused policies?
It was another productive session for mental health. We've had several consecutive productive sessions. A couple examples in this most recent legislative session of big successes were funding for the state hospital system to modernize and reconstruct some of the facilities that are available there to improve quality and access. School mental health was a big focus in this most recent session. Mm-hmm. And we saw probably some of the most significant children's mental health reforms that we've ever seen in this state. And really leveraging schools as an opportunity to intervene early and facilitate access to care.
Colleen, was there anything that didn't pass that surprised you or that you think are really going to be priorities in the upcoming session?
I think we need to further address the mental health workforce. We have an extreme workforce shortage in Texas when it comes to mental health care. And we have to look more at why our percentage of doctors who participate in the Medicaid program, you know, is so low compared to other states. Mm-hmm. But I also think more and more people are looking at really the underlying causes of mental health conditions. It's not always about mental illness per se, schizophrenia, major depression, or bipolar disorder, but it's often about the societal illnesses that create communities that aren't mentally well.
Or poverty.
Mentally healthy. You know, poverty and employment and housing, those kind of things. But we also have to think about the societal illnesses such as racism, bigotry, social isolation, despair, anger. Those things aren't mental illnesses, but the research has shown that they are the cause of much of the violence that we have in our country.
Greg, we were talking a little bit about how it's a bipartisan issue to want to provide better mental health access in Texas, but is the division over the details over how to make that access easier, or what's holding up the process of making Texas better?
Well, I think it's that it gets kind of lost in the conversation sometimes. You know, we see a lot more agreement on mental health policy than disagreement, but it's competing against many of the other significant priorities for this state. And in the last legislative session, funding for the public education system and addressing property taxes were the signature issues. And I think one of the big points of conversation in the next legislative session is going to be how well are judges, county officials, sheriffs, and other local decision makers, such as mental health organizations, working together and with the state to change the fact that the criminal justice system is the default provider or the default setting where people with mental health conditions end up in our state.
There was a window of an opportunity that seemed like there was momentum for a special session following the shootings in El Paso and Midland, Odessa. It looks like that's passed. But are you optimistic that that momentum of really doing something about mental health could continue into the next legislative session?
I am optimistic about that. And I think that that does have something to do with the fact that after these mass shooting incidents, mental health keeps getting brought up over and over again. I think that there are better reasons to address mental health in our state than trying to address mass shootings. But my sense is that the train has left the station. The legislature is going to look at the root causes of mass shootings and keep identifying mental health as one of those factors. It'll be interesting to see what specific proposals result from that conversation. There are committees in both the House and the Senate. I do think, you know, we're going to have a robust conversation around access to firearms. In some cases, we can see how a person with a mental health condition who has access to a firearm can be a dangerous situation. And usually that's the biggest concern for danger there is danger to the self. Mm-hmm. But we also need to think about danger to others as well as we look at that issue.
Colleen, jump off of that a little bit. I mean, how does it feel to be someone whose job it is literally to advocate for, you know, mental health policy? And now you have your opportunity, but it's on the back of this situation, this mass shooting that really, you know, mental health advocates are uncomfortable being tied to one another.
Right. It is very mixed. I mean, any attention to helping people who are struggling with mental wellness to become stronger and get well is certainly an opportunity we want to take advantage of. But I think some of the linking of the mass violence to mental illness in an inaccurate way can really do a lot of damage and create a lot of stigma that will prevent people from seeking out mental health services. If we talk about creating registries of people diagnosed with a mental health condition and prevent them or take away certain rights that they have in our country and our state, then how many people will be willing to go to a mental health professional and get assessed and get diagnosed and actually get treatment? And we also have to remember that other countries have the same rate of mental illness and mental health conditions as we do in our country, and they don't have the same rates of gun violence and mass shootings.
And one issue that's come up is red flag laws. That's been presented as a bipartisan issue, as low-hanging fruit. But, Greg, I could see what Colleen is saying. If you're someone who is struggling with mental health, you might not want to identify that as something at all, because if your firearms are important to you, you don't want to raise any of those red flags for family members who might overreact it when it's not necessary.
Yeah, well, and we've supported proposals to establish a red flag law in Texas, but our support for those proposals only exists because those proposals don't specifically target people with mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. The way that a red flag law should be designed is that it targets people who are exhibiting dangerous behavior. And there's the judge has discretion about what constitutes dangerous behavior. If a red flag law were to target people with mental health conditions, we would not support that because it stigmatizes mental health and therefore makes it less likely that people with mental health conditions will want to seek treatment. And that's the opposite of the outcome that we seek, which is we think everyone who needs care should have access to it.
Colleen, do you have a bottom line message for both the Texans who hold the purse strings, but also those who might be listening at home or in the car?
Having the voice of the people who use the services, having the consumer or the person with lived experience of mental health conditions and substance use conditions at the table, in the hearing rooms, at the agency, because I think far too often advocates and family members and policymakers think we know how to do it, think we know what people need, and we often don't. And I have learned over the last decade the value of the peer voice, and it should be at the head of the table, not just one seat at the table.
Greg, what about you? Any last thoughts?
I would just say that we really need to think carefully about the consequences of not appropriately investing in and addressing mental health. There are severe quality of life, financial costs, social consequences if we don't step up to the plate and address mental health in a meaningful and comprehensive way.
Colleen Horton is the Director of Policy at the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, based at the University of Texas at Austin. Colleen, thank you.
Thank you.
And Greg Hanch is the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, of Texas. Greg, thank you again.
Thanks, Laura.
Another issue both of our experts mentioned to me was the problem of the criminal justice system being the default mental health care provider in Texas. We'll follow up on this issue and what's being done about it still ahead on our show.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. On this Thanksgiving Day, we're discussing topics on mental health. We reached out to you, our listeners, for how mental health has affected you. Here are some of those stories.
The beginning of my senior year of high school, I lost my house to the Bastrop County Complex fire. That trauma really did a number on my mental health. We were fortunate enough to get our pets out of there before the fire came. And I think that, you know, it's made me a better person and more thankful. And, you know, I'm able to really put a perspective on having material things and valuing my family and my community and my health and also the environment. It makes you realize how powerful these forces are.
Kathy, my sister, first showed signs of mental illness in her mid-teens, about 1965, I think. Her symptoms worsened later on when she had children. She would go to the state hospital, but the wards were like 50 people or more. Can you imagine going through a psychotic episode and being around 50 other people Kathy really loved her children. She did her absolute best to always be kind to her kids. It was rather amazing, actually.
Probably in my teens, I noticed that there was something wrong with my mother acting like a child. There were times where she wouldn't necessarily come home, but it wasn't until I was probably early, late 20s where I understood that this is not her choosing to act that way. She eventually got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I know that it could possibly be something that might affect me, and I know there's a possibility, right? Is it a fear? No, because I know that people can live successful lives with mental illness.
The voices of Jessica Ruiz, Frank Feuerbacher, and Shelby Acosta. We still want to hear your story about mental health. Email us if you're comfortable, texasstandard@kut.org, and you can find more details at texasstandard.org/mental health.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/on the job.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. If, like many Americans today, you are getting together with family, chances are, at some point, you will talk about relatives you never even knew. For some, those relatives from long ago were kept secret, perhaps because they had a mental illness, something few people used to talk about. The Standard's Joy Diaz reports their stories used to be considered shameful.
Shame, societal norms, a lack of information may have been the reasons why Jason Lukadu never heard anything about his great-great-grandfather Jules. Back at the turn of the 20th century, few people discussed or even treated mental illnesses appropriately. But a death certificate from 1919 sent Jason Lukadu from his home in Houston to one of 10 state-operated psychiatric hospitals. That's where we met, at the San Antonio State Hospital Cemetery, where Jules is buried.
Yeah.
So where is he?
So this is about the approximately the area that he's in, a general area of where he'd be at, I was told.
1,100 graves are under our feet. Only a handful have headstones. Jules Lukadu's does not. Until he found his great-great-grandfather's death certificate, all Jason Lukadu had to go on was an article from 1896 that mentions an illness, but in passing.
It says, Mr. Jules Lukadu has been seriously ill and is in still precarious state of health. This is in February.
And so, we don't know what he was ill.
Well, that to me, that applies to his visiting the facility here where we're at today.
You think it was mental health?
Oh, yeah, mental health, definitely.
Hospital records show that just a few months after the article came out, Jules Lukadu left his home in Brownsville. His wife, his children, and admitted himself here, a place then known as the Southwestern Insane Asylum. One thought puzzles me, though. If the elder Lukadu was hospitalized in 1896, but he died in 1919, where was he all those years?
I know he was here very long. The records indicate he was here approximately 23 years. So that's a mighty long time.
That's a third of his life. So, who was this man?
Jules Lukadu is my great-great-grandfather. Basically, he's from Brownsville, Texas. He started out in the 1870s as a school teacher. Somewhere around the 1880s, he became a county assessor.
Lucky for Jason, because he was able to find lots of newspaper articles about Jules.
What I have here, Joy, is different newspaper articles from...
Jules Lukadu was a first-generation Texan, and, the son of a French man actually, and a Swiss woman. He was fluent in several languages, including Spanish. At some point, he became an immigration judge.
Today, before Judge Jules Lukadu,
with so much documentation available about him, why did Jules go missing from the Lukadu family tree? Well, maybe because back then, treatment meant getting locked away. Today, we are learning more, not only about these diseases, but as Jessica Ruiz with the San Antonio State Hospital says, we're also learning about where we come from.
I get calls every week about the same. I'm doing genealogy. Can you help me?
Sometimes she can.
Jules passed away exactly 100 years ago today.
Ruiz arranged the Lucadoux family visit and for volunteers to spruce up the cemetery grounds.
It's out here, but we have a nice setup here under this beautiful tree so you can get some breeze.
Michelle Hayden is one of the cemetery volunteers who came to pay her respects.
Sorry, I kind of get teary thinking about it. It's very touching to me. Each one of these people is an individual and is a daughter or son of our Creator. And we have a responsibility to each other as brothers and sisters.
Honoring Jules Lucadoux felt awkwardly comfortable.
My great-great-grandfather definitely is not forgotten now.
The low-key meeting of Lucadoux, Hayden, and Ruiz did not feel like strangers sharing snacks and soft drinks. It felt like a gathering of distant relatives just catching up.
What was wrong?
It was listed as a bipolar disorder.
Back then?
Yeah, bipolar. So I didn't even know you could diagnose that.
That was the Lucadoux mystery, the reason Jules' life was kept secret, and like his, so many others. On the day we met, Ruiz had a call from another family doing research.
So I was able to confirm that their loved one is here and noticed that...
She tells Jason Lucadoux that family will come here to pay their respects a few months from now. In 2020.
So, see what you started?
What Jason Lucadoux started may sound simple on its face. He started demystifying the past. He found out a person in his family had a disease, not a moral or spiritual deficiency. And now, both Lucadoux are at peace. I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU, with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Dr. Lindsay Bira, clinical health psychologist and adjunct assistant professor of psychiatry at UT Health San Antonio. The most common mental health disorders break down into a few different categories. At the very top of the list is anxiety disorders. Almost 20% of Americans do experience some type of anxiety disorder. The second most common is mood disorder. So this includes depression and bipolar. The third most common is schizophrenia and psychotic disorder. So this is much less common. The problem with something like schizophrenia and psychotic disorders is people don't know that there's something wrong with them. The people who notice it are their family. And so when I think about the top kind of five issues that I see in therapy, and the first one is guilt and shame. Guilt is about something that you did. Shame is who you are. The second category is worry. So worry about some kind of future circumstance that we can't necessarily control. The third category of pretty common symptoms is what I call overpersonalization and defensiveness. People assume it was more their fault than it actually was. The fourth one that I think everyone experiences, if you're human and alive, is procrastination. When we start to think about a task and we already start to experience it emotionally, whether it creates some anxiety, some depression, some disgust, whatever that aversive emotion is, that becomes bigger in our brain and more avoidance happens. The fifth category here is a lack of vision. This might be a toxic relationship that they're in, maybe a job that they don't like, maybe persistent chronic treatment-resistant depression that they are considering suicide. I would suggest, if you feel like something's wrong, you don't know what it is, and you just want to get a better understanding of it, find a therapist that you think talks about their practice really well, that you feel like you trust, that has a good solid background, and give them a call. Most therapists offer a 10-minute free consultation, and how you feel talking on the phone with somebody is probably going to be similar to how you feel in the room with them. I believe this is the next wave of human evolution, being able to manage these smaller subsets of symptoms so that they don't get bigger and lead to bigger problems and more stress that ends up, you know, leading to some big emotional issues and even health issues. I'm Dr. Lindsay Bira, clinical health psychologist and adjunct assistant professor of psychiatry at UT Health San Antonio. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Mental health, of course, isn't just something we consider on evenings and weekends. Many of us take our struggles with us to work. A 2018 Harris poll commissioned by the American Heart Association found 76% of employees have struggled with at least one issue that affected their mental health. 42% have actually been diagnosed with a mental health disorder, but most had not shared that diagnosis with their employer. That's just some of the data Bloomberg health journalist Cynthia Kunz points to when she describes mental health as still a don't ask, don't tell subject at work. She joins us now. Cynthia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Some people hearing about this lack of disclosure might be surprised because there are laws that protect people with mental health issues from discrimination, but how do they fall short?
Primarily, the American with Disabilities Act is the law that protects people with mental health conditions in so much as requiring employers to offer accommodations if they need it, as so long as the employee can perform the essential task of the job. But were an employee to find that their employer violated the ADA in some way, they could take that complaint to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And most of the time, the cases through the EEOC are handled through mediation. So there isn't a ton of very public case law available about how employers handle mental health in the workplace. People are free to sue their employer, but that's expensive and it exposes them publicly. And primarily, people don't want their mental health to be made public. And so this is just such a common problem that people don't want to address or talk about. And that plays into their ability to maybe push forward with large-scale reform. Mental health doesn't necessarily have the same groundswell of public protests that other sort of topics do in America. And so this discretion and anonymity, people continuing to keep this under wraps, prevents people from going through with lawsuits against employers in such a way that might more publicly expose some of the problems that happen, even with the laws being what they are, to require leave in certain conditions or accommodations. It's just a lot of people are really afraid to even ask for any of that.
Another place that you point out as needing improvement, Congress has required insurers that provide mental health coverage to offer the same level as their medical benefits. But what does that mean exactly, and is it working?
That's one of the biggest problems here. While there's a law on paper that requires them to offer mental health to the same level as other forms of medical care, they're really routinely not up to the task. They're not serving patients to the same extent when it comes to mental health care. And this can be seen through a number of ways, but probably the most salient, the one that resonates with most people that I've spoken to, is the fact that the networks are just not up to date. So the networks may have a number of psychiatrists or psychologists in them, but those doctors or therapists aren't taking new patients. They have wait lists. They don't take that insurance anymore. It really has been a tough issue to enforce around the country. And so it's sort of continued to spiral in this way that in-network care is just something that people don't even consider as an option.
So it seems from your reporting that it's really up to individual employers to make changes benefiting mental health. Are there good examples of that happening?
That's been the standout. So I've talked to a number of employers and many more who I couldn't even fit into my story who've been doing a lot to try to increase the offerings that they have and kind of do a wraparound service. Lyft is offering free mental health care through an external vendor. Microsoft is adding on-site services. And then Chevron is being more forgiving about failed drug and alcohol tests. They're very clear that safety is not going to be compromised in that case, but when they could, potentially have a forgiveness program and help people get the substance abuse treatment that they need. So employers are doing what they can, but they are in essence augmenting a system that's broken. And it really is going to take the employer pushback for insurers to start doing a better job on mental health care. And there are groups working on that. But that's a really important piece of this puzzle, because I think without insurance really existing in a very robust way, a lot of people aren't going to be able to get the care they need.
Do you have any recommendations for someone who wants to work with their own employer to make this better for themselves and their coworkers?
There is one organization. The site is called Made of Millions. They have a guide called Beautiful Brains, which is designed to help employees push for a better dialogue about mental health in the office. So there's many avenues that employees can pursue and nonprofits they can align with. But to some extent, it's going to take the companies themselves really doing the work and pushing for the change within their own insurance plans and benefits programs for this to really change on a substantial level.
Cynthia Coons covers health for Bloomberg. We'll link to her article on mental health in the workplace at texasstandard.org. Cynthia, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. We started this special edition of the Texas Standard talking about mass violence and about the ways it has been used to spark conversations about mental health. This makes many advocates uncomfortable, because while any attention to policies that improve mental health care is welcome, mental illness can also be further stigmatized by the link to mass violence, and it's a link that is often inappropriate and overused. There's a case study for the evolution in conversations about mental health and reactions to mass violence right here in Texas, because in 1966, Texas saw the nation's first modern mass shooting on an American college campus. On August 1st of that year, a sniper made his way to the top of UT Austin's iconic tower and opened fire, killing more than a dozen people there on campus and injuring many more. Texas Standard talked to close to 100 people who were eyewitnesses or otherwise remembered the events for a documentary about the 50th anniversary of the shooting. For them, it came out of the blue, the name of our documentary, because no one had ever heard of or expected something like the attack.
In 1966, we had no idea. So this was a whole new thing.
I didn't have a frame of reference in my brain to go to understand what this was and how this could have happened.
There's no, oh, this is like such and such. There's just nothing there.
It was completely unheard of. You didn't have the mass shootings and the violence then that you seem to, we seem to kind of take for granted now.
When the shots were going off, most people found other explanations for the noise.
I kept hearing what sounded like a lumber dropping. It was like a clapping sound.
Back then we had Coke bottles, so it sounded like cases of Coke bottles being placed on top of each other.
It was what I thought was construction noise.
That was the day that Schultz's Beer Garden was going to have some sort of celebration. I don't remember what they were celebrating, but we commented a couple of students to each other, oh, Schultz is starting a little early, when we heard the bangs.
And afterwards, they were called being left to deal with the trauma on their own.
My wife and I were walking down a Washington street just about 3 weeks after the event, and a car backfired, and we jumped behind a fence.
Yeah, it really messed me up. Like I say, I haven't talked about this much since it happened.
So you just dealt with things. You just dealt with what you dealt with.
So you didn't think about as much as you do now about feelings and reactions to things. So you just kind of went on.
I mean, even now, as you can tell, when I talk about it, I feel emotional, a few tears, you know, and I reflect on it on the 1st of August. And, you know, that's a little bit of PTSD, maybe.
In this case, while the mental health of the shooter was immediately questioned, that of the victims and witnesses was completely ignored. Those were the voices of just about a dozen of the many, many people we talked to about the UT Tower shooting. You can find more at towerhistory.org. Mass shootings, unfortunately, are no longer surprising as they were in 1966. We don't even hear the words, "I never thought this could happen in my community," anymore. But while not surprising, they are devastating. And so is our new normal, the cycle of news coverage after another attack, the talking points, the trainings and drills at workplaces and schools. Kids are growing up in this new normal, and parents are also adjusting. That's what inspired this next commentary.
Hi, my name is Tomás Q. Morin. I'm a poet, memoirist, and translator, and I'm currently the visiting writer-in-residence at Texas Tech University. I was born and raised in Mathis, Texas, near Corpus Christi. I'm seventh-generation Tejano. My family's history in Texas goes back a long ways before the border moved on us. The shooting in El Paso, then the shooting in Ohio that followed shortly thereafter, and the shooting in Odessa. I wish I could say that I was outraged, that I was shocked, but my outrage and my shock are depleted, as I feel a lot of people's outrage and shock are depleted in this country. I'm sure there's a lot of people for whom their thoughts and prayers are depleted as well. The El Paso shooting hit home in a different kind of way because he was targeting specifically people who look like me, who sound like me. Our country's in a state of PTSD, and I think that has its roots in the origins of our country, the way in which this country was taken and built upon the blood of Native Americans, the blood and the stolen lives of Africans. I can't help but think that a country that is taken and built in such a way that there wouldn't be some sort of anxiety about being able to lose the country in the same way, in the same bloody way that it was taken. Earlier this year, I became a father for the first time, and I am having to consider other things that I never thought I would consider before, like how my body can be useful. What's the best way to cradle him in my arms? What's the best way to balance him on my hip? And I feel like I also now have to be aware of what's the best way to use my body as a shield to protect my baby in the event of an active shooter situation. I'm sure at some point there will be a parenting class, an active shooter parenting class, because we're at a point where we need it. This is Tomás Q. Morin, and you've been listening to the Texas Standard.
Stress is killing the Black community. You know, it's just a specific history with Black people in this country. There are a lot of reasons for it, going all the way back to, you know, to slavery. You're basically siloed in your communities. Then you're policed around to stay in these communities, being reminded who you are at every turn. And you've internalized this sort of stress that comes along with that. And then it just kind of keeps compounding. Dave Chappelle had a joke. He reflected on the fact that he had gone to a therapist, and he thought about how much of a luxury that that was for you. He's like, a Black person can't decompress. It is yet another way in which, you know, the Black body sort of perishes, and it's been so normalized. We think that this is natural, and it is absolutely not.
That was the voice of Karan Spearman. Tell us your story about mental health by emailing texasstandard@kut.org. And still ahead on this special edition of the Texas Standard, a look at how two Texas police officers are helping to change the way law enforcement responds to calls. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
I am Jennifer McShane. I am the director of Ernie and Joe. My last documentary was called Mothers of Bedford, and it followed five women inside a Maxim security prison in New York State. While I was working on that, it became abundantly clear that so many people behind bars were struggling with mental illness and might even be there because of their mental illness. It'd been rattling around in the back of my head for quite a while, and then a friend flagged the work that was happening in San Antonio to me. The work they're doing is actually extraordinarily simple and very common sense, but it is counterintuitive to how law enforcement is trained.
On average, in a police academy in this country, they spend 60 hours or more learning how to shoot a gun, and they spend 8 on mental health and communication. We need to shift that.
He is now feeling suicidal and homicidal.
You know, estimations are somewhere in the 80 to 85% of all calls have an emotional crisis component or a mental health crisis. So they're just completely unprepared for that interaction.
You might be broken, but you're fixable.
If it takes me all day long to convince them that we're not going to hurt them and they're going to come with us.
How you doing? You okay?
I'll take all day long.
Oh, no, no. This is my partner, Joe. My name's Ernie.
Ernie and Joe are two police officers who are now part of the San Antonio Police Department's mental health unit. One is a 22-year veteran. One is 10 years younger, and he is a veteran and has his own kind of mental health struggles. You know, San Antonio, they have tons of issues internally, of course, that they're always dealing with, like any city would be in this situation, but they are striving to collaborate in a way that I don't see happening in a lot of cities. And that's really the secret sauce. That is the secret sauce to the success. And also, Ernie and Joe and every officer I've met has been really clear about the fact that they know they're not mental health experts. They're not trained as mental health, you know, therapists, but they also know enough to be able to identify. And I think it's that kind of huge piece, is those first few seconds or minutes to say, wait a minute, what are we really dealing with here? And diverting it. So we're not, you know, there decades ago, they will say themselves they were arresting the problem away because they just didn't know what to do.
No one calls us to give us good news. They call us because something bad is happening, and so they're in a crisis.
You know, people around the country don't always think of Texas in terms of innovation or officers thinking the way they think. So, yes, it's definitely spreading. They get visits all the time. In fact, I filmed a visit with a group of legislators, state legislators from Alabama, Missouri, and kind of just saying, well, how do we replicate this? What do we do? What's working? What's not working? But I think the important thing is to have people look at what they already have in their community and figure out, how do we collaborate and then move forward? I'm Jen McShane. I'm the director of Ernie and Joe, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
As we've heard, the criminal justice system has become the default mental health care provider for many Texans. In fact, one in four Texas inmates has a mental health need of some kind. Knowing all this, the Texas Supreme Court and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals have just embarked on a joint mission, creating the Judicial Commission on Mental Health. Its mission is to look for collaborative ways to locate and help those with mental illness as they enter and exit jails, prisons, and courtrooms. Christy Taylor is executive director of the new commission. Christy, thank you so much for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Well, thank you for having me.
There's been no major increase in the number of people arrested who have intellectual disabilities or mental illness, yet both Texas high courts felt there was something sorely lacking. Can you talk about what was happening that forced them to act now?
There are overcrowded dockets, a lack of communication, coordination, and collaboration, and a need for specialized training for our judges who are handling these really complicated cases.
So what sort of tools in the tool belt did judges have before the creation of this commission?
So one of the tools that our commission created was a bench book that would bring all of these laws together, try to simplify it, and make it more accessible to all the various types of judges in our state.
And so is what Texas is doing here, is it unique? Is it modeled on something that is happening in another state or on something else?
There are states who have set out to create commissions like this, but Texas really focused on successful models in the past. I worked with the Supreme Court Children's Commission. It was created to help strengthen courts for families and children who are in the child welfare system. And so the Supreme Court found that model really helpful. And what's unique about this commission is that the Supreme Court partnered with the Court of Criminal Appeals, sat together as one court in January of 2018 and heard from people who'd been through the system, psychiatrists, other experts who could talk about the deficits in the system.
Why is it important that these two courts operate together?
The mental health laws span across both the civil and the criminal worlds. We have families who come to us and tell us about how they have a son who needs to be committed, but it's very difficult, and that the advice that they've been given is to let him go ahead and break a law and try to access services through the jails. So they intersect quite often. We have individuals who need inpatient treatment in the civil system, and we have people who are unfortunately crossing over into the criminal justice system.
So what are examples of ways that this is working now that judges have access to this information in one place?
Well, I think we're a connector. We are helping to communicate to the legislature the laws that are already in place, where it's procedurally difficult, where it's just practically hard to carry out. And we also bring to them innovative ideas. Judges want to do the right thing. Attorneys are trying to be creative. And so we collect all those best practices, bring it to the legislature, and try to create new solutions that way.
So what about someone who's listening to this and maybe they don't personally have a mental illness right now? Why should they care about the work that you all are doing?
Well, I would challenge that. Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute surveyed Texans a few years ago and found that 76% of Texans either had a family member or a close friend that was deeply affected by mental illness. So I think it does touch our lives in a way that's different than a lot of other issues. But to your question, I think that this is the right thing to do, that we don't, as a society, want to be serving our mentally ill in our jails, that we don't want to see people with intellectual disabilities being confused for someone with criminal intent acting out from different motives, that we want people to get the right treatment and be taken care of well.
Christy Taylor is the executive director for the Texas Judicial Commission on Mental Health. Christy, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard focused on mental health. You can find segments from this program and share your mental health story at texasstandard.org/mental health. Today's Texas Standard was produced by Kristen Cabrera, Caroline Covington, Joy Diaz, Terry Langford, and me, Laura Rice. Special thanks to David Alvarez, Shelley Brisbane, Casey Cheek, Wells Dunbar, and Leah Scarpelli for their help with audio and digital. From all of us here at the Texas Standard, we wish you a happy and healthy Thanksgiving.
Philanthropic support comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Hatton W. Sumners Foundation.